You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Michigan Meta Peace Team trainer Kim Redigan about the remarkable work being done by peace teams, both internationally and domestically, and how we might be able to use peace team training in our neighborhoods to reduce violence and create safe conditions under which conflicts and grievances can be aired, addressed, and hopefully resolved.
You know, we may not name it a peace team or a peace zone, but where neighbors are interacting with neighbors, where people are keeping an eye on one another's children, where people are sharing food over a back fence, I would humbly submit that the peace work that's going on probably in every community that doesn't get that title is profound.
Hello, listeners. This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Agwanu, welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land, in and along the shores of the beautiful Bunawabskeag River in Bunawabskeag Territory here in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. I've spent the morning tweeting and posting for the various movements and the movement of movements. It's one of the hats I wear is to make sure that people are getting the news of what's going on across the world. It's very important because a lot of our mainstream news would like to be focused on other things, like elections, let's say. But it's also important for us to know what ordinary people like us are doing to make change in their towns, their neighborhoods, their counties, how they're working for justice, how they're working for change and transformation. And that brings us to the subject of today's show. We're going to speak with Kim Redigan, who is in Detroit, Michigan, and also is a nonviolence trainer with the Michigan Meta Peace Teams. She's a person who has served on international and domestic peace teams. She's a teacher, a writer, a blogger, and a water activist. And we, all three of us, Sherry, myself, and Kim, hold a fierce interest in the idea of neighborhood community peace teams and what that might look like in our world and in our own lives. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and thank you for joining us, Kim.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Kim, it's wonderful to have you here to have this discussion with us about something that is near and dear to our hearts and to help expand our knowledge base. I want to jump right in with a question about peace teams. What is a peace team and how do they function within a community?
Well, I can share my experience with Michigan Meta Peace Team. We were Michigan Peace Team, and if I slip in my use of language, because our work really is international, we've gotten more and more people on our peace teams who are internationals. We've broadened our name to Michigan-Meta Peace Team. And our model is one in which people are trained. We have a traditional 8-hour nonviolence training. And after a person would go through a training like that, they would then be able to participate in local or domestic peace teams. And then we have much, much more extensive training for folks who are going on international peace teams. So when you ask what is a peace team, I want to clarify first by saying that you could interview different folks from different peace teams, and each team, I think, is different in their philosophy. Our philosophy is what we call third-party knowledge. nonviolent intervention, which means we go to places where we are invited. We never impose ourselves. If we're invited to place a peace team, we place people who've been trained, and the idea is to simply help create a safe space for people to work out their own conflicts in a way in which everyone is kept safe. So we are not at all the peace police, nor are we marshals, nor are we there to shut down any kind of speech, no matter how awful or heinous it is, and very often it is. Our whole purpose is to create a safe space. When we do domestic peace teams, we wear clearly identifiable vests. We wear bright yellow vests that say peace team so that we're recognizable. When we do international work, not. That's entirely different. But the difficult thing sometimes is that many of us who are working on peace teams also, when we're not wearing those vests, are activists. But when we're on a peace team, because we are third party nonviolent interventionists, we don't, you know, I don't carry signs. We don't engage in civil disobedience. We're, you know, you're in a different role when you agree to serve on a peace team.
It sounds a little bit, to my layman speak, about like when you're in the airport and you go by the drug sniffing dog, or you're on the bus and you see a blind guide dog and they're on duty, they're working, you're not supposed to pet them, even though off duty I'm sure they love to be pet and they love to jump up and down and wag their tail. You've got a job and a task that you're really tasked to do in this particular circumstance. I'm curious, what kind of training goes on in the workshop? What kind of skills do people learn to do this work? Because it seems like a very specific set of skills.
Oh, that's a great question. And I want to say that, you know, that 8-hour nonviolence training is really just an introductory training. I mean, the assumption is that we're kind of giving you some tools that you can run with and continue adding tools to your toolkit. But some of the way our training is fairly formulaic. We begin with the group itself discerning what its norms for the day are going to be, you know, getting people from the get-go to function as a team. We talk a lot about affinity teams because, you know, when you're in the field, especially when you're on an international team or you're in a team where there's higher risk, you need to know who's on your affinity team. You need to know where they are at all times. And so we, from the beginning, kind of operate that way. You know, if you need to use the restroom, please let the rest of the people in the room know. If you can't stay for the day, check in with the rest of the group that that's all right. I mean, from the we work strictly by consensus. I mean, we're consensus. So the training begins with that, kind of laying the spirit of the day or the group norms for the day. And then we do have specific skills that we you know, some of the elements of a training would include, for example, we have a technique called CLARA, which is center, listen, affirm, respond, and add, which would be a skill in, you know, in a volatile situation. How can you stay centered and diffuse any escalating violence? We do some nonviolent communication skills in terms of I messages. We do a lot of role plays. We do hassle lines. We do quick decision making by consensus. So the trainings are very, very interactive. They include stories of empowerment. We always want to share stories because we know that active nonviolence works. We know that active nonviolence works. And we also know that it's, you know, it's something that one trains for. Those of us who are committed to nonviolence believe that we have to train just as hard and just as well. We need to be just as smart as, well, not just as smart. I'd say we're smarter than those who think that that violence is the only way to resolve conflict.
This sounds very familiar to the work that I did with the Maine Attorney General's office. I worked for about 6 years with the Maine Attorney General's office in their civil rights division in a project called the Civil Rights Team Project. And what we did was we went into more than 300 schools here in the state of Maine and trained students, faculty, and staff on the requirements of the Maine Civil Rights Act. As part of that process, we taught nonviolence. We taught the importance of our language. Words count was one of the trainings that I did. We also talked about safety and making sure that everybody had a safe space. We taught conflict resolution, alternative conflict resolution, mediation. So a lot of this work sounds very, very similar to that. And we have had other guests on the line that are doing work that's somewhat similar as well. My question is,
how do you see this framing the upcoming generation's ability to be able to manage conflict in a way that current leaders haven't been able to do?
Well, I would answer by saying that we are constantly self-evaluating, and it's really heartening. I mean, we've been getting more and more requests from youth, from young people. You know, our, quite frankly, our organization, the origins of the organization came out of, many of the founders of our group came from sort of the Catholic left. We have been an older group. We've been a whiter group. And we've really done some self-criticism around that and recognized the need for growth. And so as we're, you know, young people are asking for this training, and a very, very important part of the training is we can no longer talk about active nonviolence without talking about anti-racism work, without talking about structural, systemic violence. It's not enough just to say, don't be violent. If we don't look at the violence of poverty, the violence of racism, of all the isms. And so increasingly, our trainings have really, I think, deepened in terms of our social analysis. What kind of language are we using? Is it language that's accessible? How, you know, we're discussing right now, you know, the traditional 8-hour training. Well, 8 hours out of a day is not something that's, you know, there's real privilege in that, in being able to have 8 hours on a Saturday to work through a training. So we're looking now at really revising the way we train. I mean, we're in a period of exciting growth, and a lot of it is youth-led and being led by communities of color who are helping us critique the way we've been moving and helping us move into, I think, a more inclusive and a deeper and a better way to move forward.
One of the things that I'm curious to ask, I want to keep going with the applications of how peace teams could be used, but before we get there, I'd like to just dig a little bit deeper into the applications of peace teams internationally, because it's a very specific type of peace team. They work in extreme conflict zones, and I'm not sure that all of our listeners know very much about it and the rather startling success rates of what's being done around the world with unarmed peacekeeping and peace teams. Would you care to share just a little bit of kind of a background for people who may not be as familiar with it?
Well, there are different groups who are doing remarkable work around the world right now, international work. And I mean, the idea, again, is that when one is trained, when one is discerning, and when one is invited, unarmed civilian peacekeepers can do remarkable work. And, you know, there's an entire body of research, and I know, Rivera, that you've done a lot of writing on that research that supports it. With Michigan Meta Peace Team, our first international team was in Bosnia. We've had teams placed in Chiapas. We've had teams placed in Iraq. But most especially since 2002, we've maintained a fairly steady presence in Israel, Palestine. Again, at the invitation of activists who are working nonviolently for an end to occupation. And international peace teams, when we're in Israel, Palestine, frankly, there is a privilege in having a U.S. passport that we use. You need to always assess, though. You need to kind of assess, I mean, the efficacy of sending a team. We did place a team in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. That's a little more complicated. That's a little more complicated. So, I mean, it requires a great deal of research, a great deal of study, and most importantly, following the lived experience and the lead of people who are directly affected and are on the ground. You never want to place an international peace team with sort of a colonial mindset. You know, we're coming here to help people or save people. It's strictly at the invitation of people who've asked for that kind of solidarity. We like to think of our international work always in the context of solidarity.
But what do you do exactly in those situations? I mean, even I, who know a little bit about the broader context of this work, I'm terribly curious, like, what exactly goes on? How exactly, with no guns, no weapons, do you help to keep people safe and de-escalate the conflict in the area?
Yeah, I mean, there are many ways. I mean, one would be simply protective accompaniment. And there are unarmed civilian peacekeeping groups who've been doing that for a very, very long time in Central America, all over the world, actually. And in Israel-Palestine, for example, there was a time in which part of my work was with another international, was to stay in a community where people were living in caves. And they asked for protective accompaniment and for someone to provide monitoring in terms of what they were experiencing at the hands of settlers nearby who were quite violent. And so in that case, it was a matter of protective accompaniment and monitoring. At other times, unarmed peacekeepers can be placed at demonstrations where their presence can de-escalate the tendency of soldiers to engage in violence. So, you know, sometimes it's a matter of interpositioning. I mean, literally putting yourself between people. So there are different skills that one would use.
Kim, I want to go back to what you were saying before. I think that, you know, it's important for people to understand how this works on the ground. Certainly what you're talking about with the protection, sometimes it's just sheer numbers of people that you bring in to escort your group into a certain area, that just the matter of having a large number of people that's very visible can oftentimes kind of dissuade any type of violence that may be aimed against you if you were a smaller group. And there have certainly been situations that I've been in where we've brought in people, just sheer numbers of people, to provide that protection for us. And if you don't have support on the ground from some of these other forces, then you have to be really creative in how you're going to be able to manage your safety and the safety of your group in doing that work. So I appreciate you sharing that with our listeners. I also want to go back to what you were talking about before, about bringing people in with a colonizer's mind. And I think that it's really important for people to recognize that there is a degree of awareness and understanding of our shared history that's required in order to be able to have meaningful dialogue with people about what's going on in their particular area. Because a lot of the things that have happened, a lot of the places where there is violence, there is a history of colonization in those areas. And also, we don't want to perpetuate colonization going forward and instilling those ideas into the places where we go to mediate these conflicts. And I have to apologize for my scratchy throat to the listeners. I've been trying to get over a cold here. It seems to be on its way out, but it has some annoying remnants sticking around. You also talked about privilege and the issue of being able to get a passport. We recently talked to Elizabeth Murray on the show, and one of the things that she talked about was having travel restricted between groups that aren't coming to play with the big governmental leaders or what their idea is of how things should unfold. So if you're not being cooperative with whatever the particular governmental leaders want you to participate in, then your travel is restricted. And that can prohibit us from being able to gain access to one another.
Yes.
And in those instances where, you know, you have governments that are making decisions on behalf of the people in a way that actually prevents and obstructs the ability of the people to be able to reach any type of meaningful peace, do you have any suggestions for people on how do we work around that, one? And two, how do we address those issues from where we are if we can't gain access to one another?
That's the million-dollar question. And I think that that's a question that merits a deep, deep discussion. That's always the concern. That's a concern that we have. We don't know from team to team, you know, whether or not people can gain access, people can get in, people can be turned around. I mean, there's an arbitrary aspect of this. And no, it's not always arbitrary. I mean, a lot of times it's well orchestrated, designed to keep people to people, solidarity from moving forward. And I would love to hear from others how they navigate that. That's a tremendous challenge. I suppose we continue through social media. I think social media at least keeps us connected electronically. But in terms of feet on the ground, I mean, sometimes it's actual access. I mean, literally to be allowed into a place, right? It's an issue. And I don't have the answer. It's a perennial question that we struggle with.
I guess one thing to reflect on is that one of the beauty of the international unarmed peacekeeping networks is that they are working with a number of nationalities. And so sometimes when a configuration or part of a configuration is banned from an area, then another part of the configuration can come in and help. But it is a very challenging question all across the board for both unarmed peacekeeping and then also just plain citizens like Elizabeth Murray was referring to, people who would like to be building human-to-human relationships with one another to break through the propaganda and lies that countries such as our own or say Russia in a time of increasing tension kind of propagate to make us fear one another and start escalating towards war. So it's all these very important questions. I want to kind of turn our conversation back to domestic questions and the work of using peace teams in our own streets and neighborhoods and communities here in the United States. We started out that conversation in today's show just saying the very same basic principle, you go where you're invited. And I'm curious, what are some of the places that you have been invited to come and share peace team skills or practice peacekeeping? I remember that Metapeace teams did respond to initiate a call for a peace team at the Republican National Convention, and I presume there was a group that went to the Democratic National Convention. But what are some of the applications of these skills that you have engaged in our own domestic neighborhoods and streets?
Some of the more higher profile domestic teams would be, for example, at the execution of Timothy McVeigh. There was a request, I think, from a human rights group that knew that they would be, and a lot of times where the domestic teams, the invitation comes from people who are doing human rights work, who know that they're going to probably have people come who are going to be like counter-protesters. And again, we're not there to stop anyone's freedom of speech, but situations that could escalate quickly. So the Timothy McVeigh execution would be an example of kind of a high profile, or the Republican convention. We were actually invited. Our friend Eli McCarthy, who's with the Washington, D.C. peace team, was contacted by organizers, people who are organizing marches in Cleveland to place a peace team. And so we joined the D.C. peace team for that. The Republican convention, I know in Minneapolis, I wasn't part of that team, but we sent a team to Minneapolis where people in Minneapolis were forming their own local peace teams. And that was really successful at that previous Republican convention. We have done peace teams a lot of times around gay pride here in Michigan. We get a lot of times the hate mongers come out, we'll say the preachers come out, and they are very provocative. And I think often they try to provoke people to lash out at them. And so that kind of situation, often we're often finding ourselves standing between people who are trying to have an event that they've organized and really vitriolic hate mongers who really are trying to stoke violence. I know that we placed a weekend peace team a few years ago in the area where I live. We had Arab American Festival, and I really don't on the air even want to talk about what the signs that these guys brought said. I don't want to talk about some of the props that they brought with them, but it was way beyond the pale. It was far beyond the pale of anything humane. And their idea, you know, I think a lot of times it's to make money. They want to see someone lash out and go after one of them, and then they sue. So that would kind of be the normal peace team. We do a lot of that sort of thing. Last week we did a training for the entire incoming freshman class at Detroit Christal Ray High School for the third time, and that's always a delight. We spend the morning doing nonviolence workshops with the entire class coming into the high school. We do all trainings for activists, trainings for church groups, community groups.
It's really wonderful. And like I said, it just reminds me of the days when I was doing this work for the Attorney General's office, and what a joy it was to be able to work with the kids. We worked with children K through 12 schools. We worked with faculty and staff, and to be able to see the graduation of awareness that occurred in these kids over the years as they moved through these different stages of their education and different stages of their childhood growing into adulthood, and some of them continued to be a part of the program as they went into college and to initiate programs like the ones that you're talking about in their higher educational facilities, which was really encouraging and incredibly inspiring. One of the things that I want to try to kind of clarify for our listeners. You talked about groups coming in, these hate groups coming in. Certainly Westboro Baptist Church is one of those groups who tries to incite violence.
Yes.
They actually try to get people to physically assault them. They try to get people to react instead of responding in meaningful ways, because that's how they make their money.
Yep.
I think it's important for people to understand that they're purposely trying to incite them in order to be able to sue them to increase their income, which allows them the ability to continue doing this really hateful work that they're doing. And so I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's really important for people to understand. So as you're talking about training this entire class of students that's coming in, what are some of the things that you're teaching them, and how do you anticipate that they'll be applying them?
So I'll give you the outline of what we did last Friday. It's fun. It's fun to do trainings that you sort of tailor to the folks you're working with. And these are ninth graders in Detroit. And so what we did was we had four simultaneous workshops happening in the school. And so I and another trainer, we did a violence, nonviolence continuum, which is really a great exercise. Probably many of your listeners have done something similar, where one end of the wall is extreme violence, the other is extreme nonviolence, and then you give the students scenarios and they place their bodies accordingly. And we always try to give scenarios that get them to think out beyond physical violence, to get them to think about the violence of, again, racism, sexism, environmental issues. And it's a wonderful exercise for everyone, but young people love that exercise because it helps them clarify, and it also gives them the flexibility to move, you know, after they listen carefully to someone else, a perspective that perhaps they'd not considered. So I was doing that with another trainer in one room. Another room, one of our trainers, Dorothy Aldridge, is just a great civil rights icon, is, you know, for lack of a better word, here in Detroit. She was a SNCC organizer, and she was sharing stories of empowerment, stories from the civil rights movement and stories from today. She continues to be a strong human rights advocate. So she and another trainer were sharing those stories of empowerment. In another room, there were two trainers talking about social analysis, kind of going deeply into the different levels of violence, that more systemic, looking at things systemically. And then in another room, we talk about arts and activism. We have found when we're in the field and we're doing peace teamwork that art can sometimes take you somewhere where words never will, although of course words are art as well. But I mean, I'm thinking of times at checkpoints when people bring out violins and they play music, and what that does, or someone begins juggling or blowing bubbles or singing songs, or, you know, using murals and art and painting. So we really want to hold up for young people the importance of creativity. Probably at its core, I think active nonviolence requires a knack for creativity. And I think when we tap into that, and these young people are just phenomenal, they get it. And if we had time, I'd love to share a story of something that a young woman did. It was one of the most creative, nonviolent things I've ever witnessed in my life. So we try to nurture that, like really use the arts to help promote nonviolence and peace.
We would love to hear the story if you'd like to share it.
So this was a few years ago, and it was at the Arab American Festival that I was just talking about. And I'm not going to call the name of the preachers out, but they are of the Westboro ilk. And they were being very, very provocative, and they were really focusing on one young woman, I think because she was brazen. I mean, she was not backing down. And they were calling her mother every kind of name imaginable, telling her that, you know, she's going to burn in hell because she's a Muslim and, you know, she's dirty this and dirty that. It was really, really bad. So at one point, this young woman on her own initiative went across the street and came back with a big glass of water, and she handed it to the chief preacher, and she said, "Mr. Preacher," she said, "your mouth must be so very, very dry." She said, "You have been talking for hours. In my religion, we teach hospitality and welcoming the stranger. Welcome to our festival." And she gave him this drink of water. And, I mean, it just shut him down. And I was fortunate. I had my, you know, we always document and have, you know, cameras with us and so on. I got a beautiful picture of her handing him this water, and I keep it in my classroom. And every year I share that story. She was the consummate creative peacemaker, and it really did give him pause. It shut him down.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
I see the birds swimming in the sky. In the water, all the fish can fly. Reflections of what's real. They show the facts, but the truth they hide. When are they gonna let you fly? No, no, now. That ain't the deal. You are another reflection of me, just a ripple on reality, a bubble in the deep blue sea, a mirror on eternity. Yeah, no, 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 no.
Since we're speaking about peace teams this week on Love and Revolution Radio, let's explore the origins and the broader context of this idea. As with many nonviolence ideas, Gandhi figures prominently in this story. Wikipedia reports that Shanti Sena is a term for peace teams that was first coined by Gandhi when he conceptualized a nonviolent volunteer peacekeeping program dedicated to minimizing violence within the Indian population. The words Shanti and Sena both come from Sanskrit. Shanti means peace and Sena means army, or a drilled band of men. Narayan Desai, who co-founded a number of peace team organizations and picked up the legacy of the Shanti Sena network, recalls the first time he heard the term Shanti Sena. He said, "During World War II, when Japan was advancing on India, I was lying in my room one night and my parents thought I was asleep. But I was just pretending to be asleep because, like all children in the world, I wanted to listen to my parents. So they were talking about me, which made me even more interested." Narayan goes on to say, the topic was this. That afternoon, Gandhi had said that if he had an army of nonviolent soldiers, he would like to defend the country nonviolently by standing before the advancing Japanese troops. And so these two members of Gandhi's ashram were trying to decide which of them should join the army. Since they had an adolescent child, namely me, they were thinking that one of them should stay behind. That way, at least one of the parents would survive. My mother was saying, he is nearly grown now and you can probably look after him better. Let me join the army. But my father was saying, even if I remain behind, I might not have time to look after him, so I should join. That was a kind of tussling going on. But in the end, they decided they would both join, and they would leave me, their child, in the hands of God. That was the first time I heard of Shanti Sena. Perhaps fortunately for Narayan Desai, the Japanese never invaded India, and so he never quite found out exactly how Gandhi's mad plan might have worked out in his life. Subsequent uses of nonviolent struggle, however, have demonstrated the success in using it to repel foreign invasions. Narayan Desai did, however, witness the incarnation of the Shanti Sena in a number of other situations. He says that Gandhi first used the terms in 1922 during the first large-scale riots between Hindus and Muslims after his return to India. The idea kept cropping up again and again throughout the years of Gandhi's life. There were numerous regional and local groups, but before Gandhi could initiate a nationwide Shanti Sena, he was assassinated. Later, under the leadership of Vinoba Bhave and then Narayan Desai, the Shanti Sena grew to 6,000 members and intervened in a number of instances, particularly rioting, which Narayan described as small-scale civil wars. He said the Shanti Sena would first announce that they were coming to an area through media and radio, which helped open the doors to talk with officials. They would then try to convince the police to refrain from using further violence to dispel crowds, offering them other options. They themselves would patrol the streets, talk with people, hear grievances, and start to initiate committees to address the conflict, asking the two sides to recommend committee members from the opposite side of the conflict. In some cases, when the violence did not de-escalate from other approaches, they would launch their bodies into the rioting crowds, chanting peace slogans and interpositioning themselves between direct physical violence. As Kim Redigan will discuss later on in today's program about her work with peace teams, the efforts of all peace teams work best when they're paired with a holistic approach to community building. In India, the Shanti Sena also worked to build humanitarian relief and local infrastructure, addressing long-lasting conflicts and creating fertile ground for healing and reconciliation. Crisis response was just one of its capacities. It's difficult to know how many conflicts peace teams and Shanti Sena groups have de-escalated or helped to resolve. Peace Brigades International has worked in Nicaragua, El Salvador, North America, Guatemala, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Haiti, the Balkans, Mexico, Indonesia, Nepal, Kenya, and Honduras. Nonviolent Peace Force, another organization, has also been active in many of those places and adds to the list Myanmar, the Philippines, South Sudan, Ukraine, and several regions in the Middle East. This offers us just a small glimpse into the vitally important work of the various forms of unarmed peacekeeping, peace teams, and nonviolent conflict resolution. Understanding the broad applications of this work, past, present, and future, is one reason why we say it's useful to know your nonviolent history, because it might change your life. This week's music is Reflections by Sean Mercer from his album by the same title. You can find more of his music at www.seanmercer.com. And now, let's return to our conversation with Kim Redigan. Those are the kind of stories that give you shivers and chills and make you really kind of viscerally understand the power of what we call active nonviolence. These stories of the situation in an international war zone where the guns are pulled, they're ready to fire, and someone walks up and starts doing a clown routine, and the guns slowly lower down. It sounds like something a novelist like myself would make up, but in reality, it happens. These stories are true. And what I like about the work that you're doing so much, Kim, is that you're taking these stories, the knowledge that we've gained from years and decades of hard-won experience, of real dangerous experience, of real questioning and critiquing and investigating, and you're bringing them to a new generation of people, like this entire high school class for 3 years running, three of those classes. I mean, next year when you do it, it means you'll have every single year in that school has been trained in nonviolence. I can't even imagine what my high school might have been like if we had all gotten that training. And what's so powerful about this approach is the understanding that conflict happens. In our society, violence happens. We haven't gotten to a point where it's not the norm. And so why aren't we training our young people, our old people, everybody in these very practical skills for resolving conflict without the use of violence? And that brings me to my next question for you. I would love to ask you about domestic peace teams and where you think we might go in the next phase of this work in our own towns, in our own communities, in bringing these skills into our daily lives.
It's clear to me that local community peace teams absolutely, positively must be indigenous to the neighborhood from which they come, right? I don't think the idea of a train, no matter how well trained a particular peace team is, I think that at best we can train people because we have a skill set, you know, it's a skill set that's been learned. We can share those skills with people, but then it's on people to take that into back to their neighborhoods where it takes on, you know, the culture of the neighborhood. It has to be owned by the neighborhood. It has to be run by the neighborhood itself. Here in Detroit, we have a well-respected group called the Coalition Against Police Brutality. And out of that, the late Ron Scott, who died this year, what a great man of peace. Ron was very involved, probably the foremost activist in Detroit in terms of anti-police brutality. But Ron realized that communities needed to really empower themselves and take care of themselves. And so he started a beautiful, beautiful organization called Detroit Peace Zones for Life. I love it. Detroit Peace Zones for Life. And the idea is that, yes, neighborhoods, one neighborhood at a time, that people would create peace zones. And it's the work happens and starts and fits because, quite frankly, we never have the money to really. The money is always a problem. Unfortunately, we spend some of the energy that we'd like to spend doing the work, sometimes trying to raise money. But what Peace Zones for Life has done has been really, really great in terms of saying these are our neighborhoods and we know what our neighborhood needs to make it a safe community. I think that we're looking at atomization in our country that's so profound. And, you know, we have another great person in Detroit by the name of Yousef Shakur, and he talks about putting the neighbor back in the hood. I mean, really, to be a peace team means that you're a neighbor. You know one another. You're in relationship. You're in community. I mean, those are the core skills to being, you know, to doing peace team work. It's to be neighborly.
I think that's so vitally important for people to think about. We have been having discussions in my own community about how do we address, as a community, the issue of some serious drug use that actually is posing a risk in such a small community where there have been two meth labs that have been uncovered in a very, very small area. And in places where there are a lot of children playing in the area, and how do we come to that challenge and be able to address it as a community that's based on our own cultural and traditional values?
Right.
And how do we reclaim our communities and our sense of place within our communities in such a way that preserves the right of others to be there? How do we set those boundaries, set those ground rules, create a safe space that allows for the emergence of a real sense of community to be renewed, because we've become so separated from one another? We've become so fearful of one another.
Yes.
And the importance of those kinds of things, because the whole world is made up of a bunch of small communities. And when we talk about doing this work, we talk about really localizing our efforts, that's what we have the ability to do, is to address what's going on in our local communities. And if we all took the time to really address what was going on in our local communities, we could radically change the world very quickly. And so this work about Peace Zones for Life, I mean, how amazing is that? How wonderful is that? And how inspiring for all of those who are wondering what they can do. So what are some of the things that come out of these peace zones? What are some of the actions or some of the plans or some of the activities that people might be able to engage in? Or, you know, is there another source of information that people can track down to look at how they can do this within their own communities?
Well, I would say first that a lot of it is being done in communities in ways that maybe we don't name. You know, we may not name it a peace team or a peace zone, but where neighbors are interacting with neighbors, where people are keeping an eye on one another's children, where people are sharing food over a back fence, where people are finding ways to work through an economy that just isn't working for them in a way to survive, I would humbly submit that the peace work that's going on probably in every community that doesn't get that title is profound, if that makes sense. I know here in Detroit, with the water struggle that we have, if I want to look at what a peace team looks like, I look at the neighbors who are using their hoses to get water to their other neighbors who've had their water cut off. I'm looking at people who are delivering water to neighbors who don't have water on their own dime, when they don't have much of a dime of their own to spend. I mean, that's at the root and the heart. The peace is the fruit of that kind of love and compassion and justice. I think it's so multi-pronged. I'm not being evasive, and, you know, I'm not at all trying to be evasive, but I think that it begins with relationship, relationship, relationship. And it also comes from, I think, really saying we can't talk about peace unless we talk about the poverty and the racism and all the things that, I mean, I'd like to see the day come when we don't need peace teams, because we're living in ways that are just, and in ways that are neighborly, and there would never be a need for a peace team. I'd love to see that day come.
Kim, I think you brought up so many beautiful points, including where peace really starts and how it's expressed every day. And then just one of the things that when we forget to do those things of being human with one another, that's the void where the escalation of violence and domestic war comes in. And that happens all over the place. I want to just share two stories with the listeners to get a framework for this work on another whole level. That, of course, many of us know the story of Ceasefire Chicago, which de-escalates and de-escalated gun violence in their neighborhoods through the use of these peace team skills. Again, another local to your neighborhood group that really used their own understanding of their own struggles, their own situation that they were working in to help resolve a conflict in their own community. Another story is the Love Walks in the LA Love Walks, which also were dealing with gun violence in their neighborhoods and gang violence. And when the mothers decided just to go out on the streets at sunset and walk the streets.
Yes.
Handing out sodas and potato chips and making discussions. There was also a recent situation, I think it's still ongoing, and Kim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was in Chicago, where there were episodes of violence that were breaking out, there was retaliatory violence threatened, and the mothers set up an occupation on the streets in armchairs for the duration of the height of the tensions. And this is a current one. This is one that's going on right now, where they're saying, not on our watch. We're going to be present. We're going to sit here. We're going to make sure that you know we're here and we don't want this violence to happen. So this stuff gets real, real fast. And it happens on every level, as you said. I want to ask you a little bit about one kind of interesting angle, and it's a little bit out there. It's an oddball one, because we began at the start of the show talking about the spectrum of violence to nonviolence, and including within our exploration of the definition of violence, things like structural violence, systemic violence, cultural violence, economic violence. And I was thinking, I grew up in a white area of the country, or my communities were white. But structural violence was something was going on every single day. I mean, people in my communities were practicing structural violence of classism, of unobserved racism. I mean, in every action that they were doing. What do you think about peace team or even peace skill efforts on interrupting and intervening in those behaviors? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like I said, it's a bit of an oddball question, but maybe you've thought about it.
I think that that's, I'm not quite sure very exactly what you're asking. I cannot be a person who does peace work, violence de-escalation work at all, unless I'm also a person who throws in 100% on issues having to do with the structural violence, with the systemic violence. So I think there's a dance of, you know, or you're kind of going back and forth or wearing two different shoes. One is that more kind of objective third party, create the safe space. But then the other for me is to wear the activist shoe, which says we have to change these structures of injustice. I wasn't quite sure exactly what you were asking.
What I was thinking about was that many of the people in the place that I grew up, they have shopping habits, spending habits, cultural viewpoints, all of which engage in actively structural violence. They have jobs and professions. Some of them work in the military-industrial complex. So maybe that does fall in what you're saying, the other hat of being an activist.
Yeah. Yes,
I think that's a really important question, Rivera, for all of us to contemplate, because we always think of this work in relation to some other, and we always think of this work in relation to some other that oftentimes doesn't look like us. And so it's much harder for us to see these incidents of structural violence, or at least it has been historically harder for people to recognize some of those things and to kind of call them out in a way that is effective and meaningful. And when we're doing this type of work, oftentimes we look at our own communities last, meaning the people that really look like us and kind of act like us and think like us in the majority of ways. And we need to be really clear about where do these things originate? Where are they hiding in plain view? What are our own blind spots in dealing with this type of work? And so I think that that's really kind of key and fundamental to what both of you are saying, that, you know, you can't be doing this work if you're not also doing this work in your own life.
Right.
You know, it's really kind of fundamental. And so what are some of the ways that we can be really looking at how this plays out in our own lives, in our own communities, in places where people do tend to look like us and maybe even are standing beside us? What are the ways that these things manifest even within our own movements? And how can we watch for them? Do you have any suggestions, Kim?
I certainly think where you place your feet determines everything. And I think to find mentors and teachers with whom you can walk and journey and form relationship and really listen when you ask, can you please, you know, we kind of have accountability agreements. I'm asking you to hold me accountable. I'll use the example here with the water issue. Well, I'm not directly affected. I have water running in my house. And frankly, I have the privilege, if I wanted to, I could jump in and out of that activism work. But my accountability would say, no, you're all in. You know what I'm saying? You throw in completely on the side of justice. You have to always be and asking people, please check me on this, you know, please teach me. I think humility goes a very, very long way. And if I've learned nothing else on peace teams, it's to be quiet and become small and listen and be led. That would be at the core for me of what it means to do well with this work is to allow oneself to be humble and be led and listen.
That's really beautiful and really good reminder for all of us. I know something that Sherry and I do a lot is we dialogue. If something's bothering me, I'll bring it up and vice versa. And just to open that conversation, and a lot of people, my culture that I come from, was very much about smoothing over the uncomfortable parts of our lives, not looking at them, not being willing to open that can of worms, don't talk about politics at the dinner table, that kind of behavior of, you know, if it hurts, don't look at it. But as we know, that behavior leads to festering wounds, gangrenes, and ultimately amputations. It's not a very good healthcare policy, and it doesn't work very well for social justice either. And so being willing to look, I think, is maybe a really important component of that. We're heading into the last 5 minutes of our show, and I want to remind the listeners that we're speaking with Kim Redigan, who is a nonviolence trainer with the Michigan Meta Peace Teams. She has served on international and domestic peace teams. She's a teacher and a writer. She has a wonderful blog, Right Time for Peace, that's W-R-I-T-E, which I have read and enjoyed immensely. She's also a water activist, and she lives in the Detroit area. Kim, I have so many questions that I would like to ask, even before giving you a last moment to kind of wrap the conversation and tell people where they can learn more and find out more. But one of the questions that's still brewing in my heart right now to ask is that all across our country, we're having a hot and intense nationwide debate about policing, police skills, the role of police in our communities. And I'm curious to ask you your viewpoint on these types of peace team skills in our communities in actually becoming a method of intervention. So no matter if we have a really great police department or a really abysmal, violent, brutal police department, we have skills to start resolving the conflicts that are at our door without having to pick up that phone and call somebody else in to actually intervene. What are your thoughts on that? I think it's so important to look at.
That is absolutely, absolutely correct, Rivera. And that is, in fact, the premise that Ron Scott, that when he came up with the Detroit Peace Zones for Life, that was precisely his premise. And that's what we would have hold up as our vision as well with Michigan Meta Peace Team, is that you not have to pick up the telephone. That a skill, people would develop the skills and develop the relationships to not have to call in the police. I agree with you 100%. that would be what community peace teams would be all about. I mean, that would be at the heart of it. Self-regulating communities.
I agree with both of you on that. And there have been some examples, and perhaps we can get somebody on the show who's participated in this. There have been some examples that have been successful that have cropped up following some of the police shootings in areas where there seems to be a lot of police violence. There have been citizens who have taken it upon themselves to go out and to resolve conflicts on the streets when they see them begin to emerge so that they don't have to call the police. And, you know, that's an issue that we should really be looking at is what is our role and what is our responsibility in managing our own conflicts? And how do we address the issue of police violence that's associated with conflict resolution, almost saying that tongue in cheek, and what are our roles as citizens in managing our own conflicts? And do we have to start stepping up and taking more responsibility for that to actually minimize the influence and the impact that the police have on our daily lives? We all complain about police brutality. We complain about this police state that's developing. And yet we've kind of cast off our own responsibility for managing our own conflicts in many areas of our lives. A lot of people don't know how to manage conflict. They avoid and they dismiss and, you know, they kind of skirt around it. Like Rivera said, they smooth it over. So, you know, there are a lot of things there for us to really start thinking about. But as we head into these last minutes, this last minute probably of the show, what is it that you would like our listeners to take away, and where might they find more information on what it is that you're doing?
They could visit www.metapeaceteam, one word, metapeaceteam.org. And I guess what I would say is let's be the communities that we want to see. We would reduce violence radically if we had art programs for children. If some of our people in Detroit who are doing great work are doing drama, doing gardening. Let's create the communities that we want to see, with the peace team being a piece of that. I think we start young. Let's have systemic justice and see what that would look like, and systemic neighborhood building and see what that would look like. I believe underneath all this violence really is fear, despair. And so, you know, what is the antidote to fear and despair? It's community.
I need you to be love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our incredible guest, Kim Redigan, and to my always inspiring and brilliant co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. I so appreciate everything that you have to offer to me, to our guests, and to our listeners. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, Words and Music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry, for all of your great comments. If any of you listeners are out there and you've been enjoying the things that Sherry's been saying on this show, I should remind you that Sherry also posts on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, which is a really great place to connect with more of her thoughts in longer detail even. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program. Your local radio station can broadcast it. Please ask them to do so. It's really easy, it's really fun, and a lot of people have been doing this lately, so go with the flow, right? You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week, Kim Redigan has inspired us to think of all the ways that we can initiate peace work in our everyday lives. We heard about peace teams in the schools and peace zones for life, which I loved. So I ask you now, listeners, what other ideas do you have for incorporating the practices of peace and nonviolence in your lives and in your communities? Perhaps you'll take the time to think about that very thing by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew?